Our second case this morning is United States against Campos. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Major Chris Broadston, and together with Lieutenant Colonel Richard Posey, I represent the appellant in this case, Juan Campos. Chief Judge Efron, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This court has stated that the military judge has an independent duty to examine stipulations to determine their admissibility under the MREs and under RCM 811. This court has also said that when the interests of justice apply, the military judge should keep those stipulations out. Likewise, this court has stated that the military judge is the gatekeeper for expert opinion evidence. Here, there was no permissible use for the stipulation of expected testimony by Dr. Arnold, and the military judge committed plain error by failing to keep that stipulation out in the interest of justice.
I understand your argument about failure to object preserve doesn't kill plain error analysis, but why, with respect to the first two prongs of obvious error, why, if it's obvious and so on, why wasn't it IAC not to object?
I believe that was one of the issues that we raised in our supplement, but that was not the granted issue, unless I'm sadly mistaken.
But you would view it as IAC?
We believe that is a potential problem, yes, sir.
Do we know if the defense attorney had seen the contents of the stipulation before entering into the pretrial agreement?
That's my understanding from the record, yes, sir.
That he had seen it?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Appellant believes that there are three main issues with the stipulation. The first is that it was not proper opinion evidence as to rehabilitative potential, and also it was not proper aggravation evidence. The second is that it contained a specific recommendation as to sentence, and the third is that it relied on collateral matters of good availability, good time, and the sexual offender treatment program. Essentially, this entire stipulation was a general opinion on the sexual offender treatment program, its effectiveness in rehabilitating offenders, and the recidivism rates for offenders. We would argue that this was not admissible under RCM 1001B5 because the doctor clearly had no knowledge whatsoever about the appellant or his offense. It also was completely irrelevant to any issue at hand.
This isn't just forfeiture, is it? He didn't just remain quiet. He positively, you know, it's part of the PTA. He agreed to put it, you know, the appellant and his counsel positively, explicitly agreed to put this in.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why is it not waiver or invited error?
Well, certainly we would argue that invited error does not apply in this case, Your Honor. This court has fairly strictly used invited error in those cases where the defense has literally brought the evidence in themselves or opened the door by arguing first before the trial counsel did. In this case, the only possible use for this stipulation was for the trial counsel during sentencing and the trial counsel.
Well, the only possible use for this stipulation was to get a favorable PTA.
Well, that was one of the factors that the...
Well, one would assume that was the only factor. He wanted a PTA. He agreed to let this thing in.
Yes, Your Honor.
How can he now be heard after having... I'm not talking about sitting mute, you know, plain error, forfeiture, plain error. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about explicitly concurring under the terms of a pretrial agreement to put this thing in. How can he now be heard to complain about it?
Yes, Your Honor. In the pretrial agreement, the appellant did not agree not to object.
No. It was a stipulation of testimony and can be treated like any other stipulation testimony.
Yes,
he can attack the testimony. He can point out inconsistency of the testimony. It appears he did none of that.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And that leads you back to the IAC issue.
That leads you back to the IAC issue, but I'm not going there.
Yes,
I'm just saying he agreed explicitly to put this thing in and then sat mute as to its merits at trial. And why are we now discussing it?
Your Honor, we would argue that would be the exact same thing as if, the trial counsel actually called the doctor and the trial defense counsel sat mute and and didn't object to the testimony. Because if there was no objection, it simply raises a plain error.
No. The appellant ordinarily has nothing to say about who the trial counsel calls. Here, it's part of the PTA. He's got something to say about it. He can agree to it or not agree to it in the negotiations on the PTA. He explicitly agreed to let it in.
Well, Your Honor, we'd agree that just looking at the PTA, all that agreement does is stipulate to that's what the doctor would testify to if he was called to testify.
Well, but the PTA says, I will agree to this stipulation of expected testimony by Dr. X.
Yes,
right?
Your Honor, it does, but it also says that it can be attacked or objected to.
Right, because that's inherent in the stipulation of testimony.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
Counsel, to go back to the ineffective assistance of counsel, please correct me if I'm misreading the record, but as I look at your petition supplement, the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel was not raised before this court. It was raised before the lower court, but not before our court. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Are you now asking for the opportunity to brief that issue?
No, Your Honor, we're not.
Okay.
The court, however, may consider that issue on that.
Then why doesn't that inform the plain error analysis?
If you look
at the Clark case, which is somewhere here, which is the polygraph case, there's language in there about how inadmissible. Hang on, I'll try and find it here for you. Evidence that otherwise would be inadmissible under the MREs may sometimes be admitted at trial through a stipulation if the parties expressly agree, if there's no overreaching on the part of the government in obtaining the agreement, and if the military judge finds no reason to reject the stipulation in the interest of justice. And I'm not sure why I read that, but I'm stalling to give you some opportunity to think of an answer to the question.
Thank you, Your Honor.
If it wasn't obvious enough for the defense counsel to object to, and so on, I guess judges are supposed to know more than defense counsel.
Yes, Your Honor, we would point to the language in Clark there where it says, you know, as we noted before, if the military judge finds a reason to keep it out in the interest of justice, he has an independent responsibility to do so. We believe that in this case, the error was very plain and very obvious, and the military judge should have seen it. We would argue that even though the defense counsel did not object and for some reason did not admit or withdrew his offer of Dr. Armand's email to him, the military judge still should have known that the...
What's your prejudice argument? Because here the your front end hurts your back end potentially. In terms of if it's that plain because it says on its face that he hadn't met with the appellant or had no knowledge of the case, so that makes it, in your view, plain that it had no business being in on foundation grounds. But that same plainness then is available to the judge to disregard it in prejudice. You know, it was clear to the judge that this guy didn't have any basis to make these opinions with respect to this appellant.
Yes, Your Honor. We would argue that because we believe the stipulation was inappropriate for the military judge to consider or use during at arriving at a sentence for the appellant, that the sentence itself is evidence that the military judge used it, but also we'd point to the joint appendix at page 13 when the military judge was discussing the stipulation with the appellant. The military judge asked the appellant, do you consent to the use of these stipulations? Later asked the appellant, do you accept the use of these stipulations? To us, that signals very strongly that the military judge did, in fact, use those stipulations.
Isn't the military judge required to make those inquiries with respect to any term in the pretrial agreement?
Your Honor, there is standard language, the gouge that the military judge goes through.
Which is, do you agree to whatever is in the pretrial agreement, right?
Yes, Your Honor. But
and given the fact that this term, this the use of this stipulation was in the pretrial agreement, the military judge was aware that the defense counsel and the government counsel had agreed to its use, right?
Well, Your Honor, we would argue a slightly nuanced reading of that, and that we don't agree that the PTA required the appellant to admit to the use of the stipulation. It only required the appellant to stipulate that this is what Dr. Arnold would say if he was called. So we believe.
Well, and he agreed to let it in.
The appellant did at that point.
Yeah. Okay, so, that's more than simply saying this is what he would have said. He agreed to let that stipulation in. He didn't have to agree to that.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. And
they could have made him bring Arnold in.
That's absolutely correct,
Your Honor. Right.
We believe that the military judge, in the interest of justice, should have realized that was inappropriate.
So the military judge should have just sua sponte busted the PTA.
It would not have been a bust of the PTA in this case, Your Honor, because
it's a term of the PTA.
It was a term, but the term of the PTA was that the appellant would agree to stipulate to the testimony of Dr. Arnold. It didn't say that the appellant would agree to have the testimony admitted or would agree not to attack it or object to it. So if the military judge sua sponte said, this is inadmissible, I'm not going to accept this, that would not have broken the terms of the PTA. Additionally,
well, you think the government would just happily gone on its way and said, oh, that's all right?
The government may have objected to that, Your Honor. We don't know what would have happened had that happened. But we would also...
Would you admit that at least tolerably it could have busted the PTA? Because this is a term of the PTA?
We certainly concede that the trial counsel may have argued that.
No, that's not what I'm asking. I'm asking... The military, they bring in this PTA. Now, you know, what you want the military judge to do is say, I'm not going to let this stip in because A, B, C, D. And the trial counsel is going to get up and say, well, then we have no PTA. And then the appellant is going to say, what?
Well, Your Honor, the appellant would argue that it was only an agreement to stipulate to the expected testimony. It wasn't an agreement to admit to the admissibility of the stipulation. It wasn't an agreement.
Okay, so what you're saying is they didn't agree to anything but to stipulate to this thing.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's dependent on, there's a condition subsequent that the judge let it in.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. And this court
has... So you would rely on paragraph I of the PTA. The plain language of paragraph I.
We're looking at...
On the question of prejudice, you cite the two other cases that you indicate Dr. Arnold's, whatever that thing is, came in. The Dunn case and the Goldberg case, I believe. Are those appropriate cases for us to consider the facts in those cases?
This court is, you know, obviously not required to consider those, but we believe that it is appropriate for the court to consider those.
Does the record reflect or something we're allowed to look at indicate whether those are the sum total of the cases where Dr. Arnold's testimony came in?
The appellant doesn't have information as to whether those are the sum total. Anecdotally, I know that there are other cases in other jurisdictions that have admitted that stipulation.
If it's a published opinion and it's Dr. Arnold, is it appropriate for us to consider that? I'm saying this because I'm going to ask the government the same. So,
for the purposes of determining whether the military judge committed error here, we believe it is appropriate because it was the same military judge and the same stipulation of fact.
If parties agreed to let evidence in without a proper foundation being laid?
This court has said that in some cases the parties can stipulate to evidence that would otherwise be inadmissible.
And for tactical reasons, isn't it the case that sometimes people don't make objections to evidence that they could object to?
That's true, Your Honor.
So I guess this goes back to Judge Baker's question at the beginning is, why would it be plain and obvious to the military judge that he needed to undo something that appeared that the parties had agreed to? Even if they didn't have to.
Your Honor, I guess that we would just go back to the argument that this was simply an agreement to stipulate to what Dr. Arnold would testify to. It wasn't an agreement to admit this stipulation. And if I may just...
What in the... I'm sorry, were you done answering the question?
Oh, I thought I had.
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, I was interrupting, and I wanted to make sure I'm happy to interrupt your thought, but not your answer. What in the whatever this thing is in Dr. Arnold's statement is not part of the sort of common knowledge that a professional judge would know about child porn and pedophilia and all that stuff?
Well, Your Honor, we believe that the real problem here is the specific sentence recommendation and the fact that it was so closely tied to the rehabilitation program. We don't know that it's common knowledge or a military judge has common knowledge of a certain amount of time that's required as far as confinement for an appellant.
The minimum sentencing of 48 months is paragraph 28. Is that what you think?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is the rest of this stuff pretty much stuff that a military judge would be expected to know from their professional existence?
We think that would be a reasonable assumption, or certainly not unreasonable.
What was the maximum sentence that the appellant was exposed to based on the charges in the case?
I apologize, Your Honor, I don't recall.
It was significantly more than four years, right?
Yes, it was, Your Honor.
So isn't it reasonable to perhaps assume that the appellant entered into the pretrial agreement thinking that 48 months, which was the sentence cap, was a good deal, and that the recommendation with respect to the minimum amount of confinement by the expert, or you know, the testimony that the stipulation in this case helped him, not hurt him?
Well, we certainly don't. We would not see it that way, Your Honor, if the military judge otherwise would have given the appellant 2 years instead of 48 months, instead of 4 years, then it certainly could be. We have no way of knowing.
But presumably the appellant expected that his exposure was greater than 4 years, or he wouldn't have entered into the pretrial agreement, right?
That's true, Your Honor.
Counsel, you just said that the real problem here was the sentence recommendation in the stipulation. Is that a better argument than your argument that Dr. Arnold never evaluated or saw Campos?
Well, I guess the prejudice here occurs when the appellant receives the minimum 48 months mandated by Dr. Arnold. Just part of the analysis this stipulation, the reason that it's inadmissible is because looking at RCM 1001B5, the foundational requirements, that it simply doesn't meet those terms.
Vince, in your argument, that would knock it out completely.
Yes, sir. And the sentence recommendation is specifically tied to the treatment program. As a matter of fact, that's the way that the trial counsel argued it in his closing.
Don't we presume that military judges know and apply the law?
Yes, Your Honor, we do.
Don't we presume that military judges know who does the sentencing and where it comes from?
Yes, Your Honor, we do that also. But in this case, we would argue that the military judge is not entitled to that presumption in this case.
Why not?
Well, Your Honor, we would argue that due to the pervasiveness of the trial counsel's use of the stipulation, due to the fact that the military judge, talking about the stipulation, asked the appellant if he consented to its use, due to the fact that the stipulation was wholly inadmissible, not permissible in any way, and as military judges often do when there's some question as to the admissibility of evidence coming in, the military judge made no statement on the record as to how or to what extent he would consider this evidence. I see I'm out of time.
You may take the time you need to finish your answer to the question.
Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Well, some.
You'll have a further opportunity on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for the government.
May it please the court, I'm Lieutenant Elliot Oxman, along with Colonel Louis Puglio, on behalf of the government. The government has argued for invited error, but as an alternative theory in this case, we also argue that this court should not grant appellant's petition for a sentence rehearing, because at trial, he affirmatively waived his right to object to the admission and use of a stipulation that he now claims was plain error to admit. Appellant waived any objection to admission of the stipulation at issue today on page 14 of the joint appendix. Furthermore, on pages 11 through 14 of the joint appendix, appellant affirmatively expressed that he understood the stipulation and that he desired to enter into it. Therefore, this constitutes a waiver, not a forfeiture. And under this court's explanation of waiver in Harcrow, which was decided this year, a waiver extinguishes an appellant's right to argue on appeal for an issue of error.
But didn't he agree to and stipulate to the admission of this document? He didn't waive his rights to attack it, to object to it, to bring another testimony. And that then becomes important in the later phase of the trial. He said, yes, I'm agreeing that this stipulation can come into evidence. Later, he failed to object to the substance of the testimony, and that's what the plain error analysis goes to. It doesn't go to whether or not he stipulated that this get into evidence to begin with. Isn't that right? True?
Well, Your Honor, I guess we're reading the language of the colloquy between the appellant and the military judge differently.
Well, what are you reading here on page 14?
I'm referring to page 13 and 14. The military judge, on page 13, when he's speaking to the appellant, he says, do you consent to the use of these stipulations? And I guess the government reads that as being able to use them, not having them, not just consenting that if Dr. Arnold came in and testified, that that's what he would have said. So
but,
I guess that's how the government reads it, is that they can use that testimony now for argument.
But the military judge has just told Campos that both Dr. Arnold and the other witness do not, that this does not admit the truth of their testimony. It can be attacked, contradicted, or explained in the same way as anyone else's testimony. So all it does is it puts it before the members, and then it's fair game for both sides to do with what they want to do with. In this case, the defense didn't do anything further. Isn't that what the plain error issue goes to, not the initial stipulation of the testimony?
Well, Your Honor, I think that we're also looking at a guilty plea, and it really... Although he admits it for use in both the providency portion of the trial and in sentencing, it's really only being used for sentencing. And if we look at the pretrial agreement, admittedly it was not worded very well, but I think what was going on in the pretrial agreement was they were allowing themselves the ability to attack the content of the stipulation of expected testimony, and in a guilty plea, you're only going to make these arguments during sentencing. And in fact, trial defense counsel made basically the same arguments that appellate defense counsel now makes about the relevance and applicability of the stipulation of expected testimony to appellant. And we would also note
that. But he didn't object to its admissibility, did he?
He did not object to the admissibility.
So, where are we as far as page 14 in the record?
Oh,
and
yes,
that is, do we have a situation in which the defense agreed to the admissibility of these documents in the same fashion that if the prosecution said, we're going to offer evidence in sentencing by an expert, and we're going to have the expert come here, and the expert is not someone who's interviewed this particular accused, and he's going to testify as this expert here goes, and the military judge says to the defense counsel, do you have any objection to the witness testifying in that fashion? And the defense says, no. Is that what we have here? Is the defense then saying, no, we're not going to object to the content of that stipulation coming into evidence?
No, Your Honor, that would be almost too perfect of a scenario, but we don't have that here. I mean, we would be arguing this, I think, if that had happened.
Right, so if we don't have that here, then the defense did not waive its ability to object to the content of any particular aspect of the stipulation once the sentencing proceeding began. Is that correct?
They did not waive their right to object to the content of the stipulation, but on page 14, and that's why I was originally saying page 14, when the military judge was speaking to trial defense counsel, He asked them, do both the counsel for both sides desire to enter into each one of these stipulations? And defense counsel told the military judge, yes, sir. He then asked, are there any objection to any of the stipulations? And defense counsel said, no, Your Honor. So he was affirmatively saying, we have no objections.
Is there a difference between objecting to the admission, not objecting to the admission of a stipulation of expected testimony, and being able to attack the contents either through cross-examination or through argument or through extrinsic evidence?
And well, Your Honor,
what I mean by that is, you can agree to a stipulation of expected testimony, meaning I agree that this is what this person would say, and I agree that it can come, that, you know, it can be admitted that this is what he would say. But that does not stop you from bringing in a witness that will say what he said is a bunch of, you know, malarkey, or from arguing in closing, you know, this guy never even saw appellant, he doesn't know anything about him, and you should disregard what he said, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, aren't those two different things?
Yes, Your Honor, and appellant defense counsel made those arguments in sentencing about the stipulation of expected testimony that Dr. Arnold had not seen appellant. That argument was made by defense counsel in his sentencing. As far as the stipulation itself, the government would also note that at the conclusion of his explanation about rehabilitation programs, Dr. Arnold does note that before qualifying for any of these programs, anyone who might be considered for them must be evaluated. And I think that sort of also takes away from any influence, because no evidence was presented to the military judge that appellant could be evaluated. So therefore, he's not being told all this information applies to appellant. And I realize that's not exactly the answer to your question.
This gets back then to my question, because I think your answer to Judge Ryan's question is that he did waive any objection to the admissibility. The government's view is he did waive any objection to the admissibility of the testimony, no matter how incorrect that testimony would have been, or objectionable that testimony would have been on sentencing, because there was no interview of the accused, etc. He waived all those objections and merely preserved the right to argue the weight and the pertinence of it. Is that the government's position?
Yes, sir.
In the Clark case, which involved the parties agreeing to let in a polygraph, this court, so you had the same concept of waiver that you're arguing here, which is the appellant brought the thing in himself. This court looked at it for plain error and determined that the military judge had, on the front end of the plain error test, had committed that this was an obvious error, but went on to decide there was no prejudice. Are you arguing that you may put a different, may say it's not obvious error here, but let's say that it is obvious error? Are you saying we shouldn't move on to prejudice, that the waiver is the end of the game?
Yes, Your Honor, but the government is prepared to argue.
And how would you distinguish the Clark case?
Well, I'm not familiar with the Clark case, but based on what you told me, you're saying that there was a polygraph expert and both sides agreed.
They stipulated that, to the extent I get this wrong, it's not intentional. They stipulated, there was a stipulation that agreed the guy had taken a polygraph and that he had shown deception.
And this is coming.
Yeah, right. You wonder, and in the polygraph case, in light of the law on polygraphs in the military, obvious error. And this court didn't say sorry, you waived it. The court said let's move on to the prejudice piece, and it happened that the court found no prejudice. Why shouldn't we apply that same construct here, if in fact it was obvious error? I'm trying to set up the analysis before we do the analysis.
Well, I don't think that the polygraph expert and Dr. Arnold are quite the same thing, sir.
That goes to obviousness. But assuming, why shouldn't we, if it is obvious error here, I heard you saying, forget it. The game's over. You don't even get to. If it's obvious or not, he waived it.
Yes, sir. The government's position is
when... But that's not the view we took in Clark.
Well, I believe...
Two separate arguments. It's not obvious, therefore it's not plain error. Or even if it is obvious, it's not plain error because he waived it. And I hear you saying the second.
I think I'm having trouble seeing how this was obvious error, Your Honor. That's why I'm going to...
Oh, that's the first. Okay. Try me on prejudice anyway.
Okay. With regard to prejudice, is...
Are Dunn and Goldberg in this game?
Well, they're not actually companion cases here, Your Honor.
May we take note of what sentences were issued in those cases or not?
Well, they're unpublished cases. I'm not sure that that means the court can ignore their existence, but I don't think they have the same weight as a real companion case or a published case.
Well, here's what
I'm... Is there any case from our court that states that an unpublished opinion from the Court of Criminal Appeals gets any less weight than a published opinion?
I'm not aware of one.
In Dunn, it happened that the sentence meted out by the same judge with the same Arnold thing was happened to be 48 months. And in Goldberg, it was 10 months.
10 years, Your Honor.
10 years, I'm sorry. Yeah. Still higher. Here you have the 48-month thing coming up again. Why is that or is that not some indication that this military judge is relying on the Arnold formula to mete out 48-month sentences?
From one other case that we would extrapolate that, Your Honor?
Well, that's, if I take it as part of your argument, that does not make it statistically sound. Are there other cases?
I'm not aware of other cases, Your Honor, but I would say that one other case, the defense has provided two cases. One had 48 months, that was done, Your Honor. Goldberg had 10 years. On rehearing without the stipulation, Goldberg also got 10 years, admittedly from a different judge, even the identical sentence without the stipulation included in his sentencing. As far as Dunn getting 48 months, I am not aware of the exact facts in Dunn as far as what the evidence was before the military judge besides the stipulation. And I think that in this case, the evidence in aggravation went far beyond a stipulation from Dr. Arnold. This military judge was given four other extremely aggravating things to consider besides any stipulation that we're arguing about today. First, the trial counsel presented evidence of the facts behind the child pornography videos that appellant possessed, including that one was a 4-year-old girl who was being raped and molested by her father. Another video was of a little girl who was being molested by her neighbor, who was also her babysitter. And I would also note, third, that all of this child pornography, contrary to the judge's opinion in the lower court, was videos. These were not still images of child pornography. These were all videos. And fourth, the military judge in this case saw 13 child pornography videos that appellant possessed of 22 total videos. And he received a sentence of 48 months. Although appellant is arguing that he received 48 months because of the stipulation, as the government pointed out in his brief, this stipulation was not operating in a vacuum. The military judge had other evidence to consider, if he even considered the stipulation at all.
The government asked for a maximum sentence of 8 years, correct?
Yes, sir. If there are no further questions, I'll just note again that on page 14 of the record, appellant affirmatively waived any objection to the stipulation, and throughout the record, he demonstrated that a knowingness and voluntariness of that waiver. Therefore, the government respects the request.
Counsel, at what point, assuming that the error was obvious here, something you don't concede, but you're now talking about waiver, at what point did the appellant in this case have any idea of the objections that the defense is now raising on appeal?
of the objection that it was...
The defense is now raising several objections on appeal on the grounds that there was plain error as to the testimony of Dr. Arnold. And you just asserted that the waiver was knowing and intelligent. At what point was the accused, in this case, the appellant, ever informed as to the existence of the matters that the defense now says are plain and obvious errors?
Well, sir, Your Honor, that's evidenced by the trial defense counsel's sentencing argument, where he attacks the content after agreeing the pretrial agreement that this is what Dr. Arnold would say, and we reserve the right to attack it.
Right, he attacked the substance of the agreement, but he didn't attack the admissibility of it. And you've asserted that the defense had a knowing and intelligent waiver of any objection to the admissibility of that information. And what I'm asking is, at what point did the appellant in this case ever indicate that he had been informed of the matters that the defense now asserts constitute plain error?
Your Honor, the government gets that position from the military judge, not just asking appellant if he agrees that the stipulation could be admitted, but that it could be used. And we take that use to mean what we've argued.
Well, that's defense counsel's position in here, but that doesn't appear to reflect that the appellant in this case had any idea what that meant. If it meant waiving plain error objections that are now so plain and obvious as the defense says.
We would only point to our brief in the facts section, which has a chronological accounting of all relevant portions of this trial with the colloquy between the military judge and appellant, both before and after the verdict in this case, Your Honor. Okay.
Counsel, assuming that there wasn't a waiver in this case, how do you respond to the appellant's argument that RCM 1001B5C requires that there be a personal evaluation?
Your Honor, I believe in the government's brief we conceded that 1001B5 is not the best way to bring in this evidence. We said that it came in under 1001B4. If the court feels it can come in under 1001B5, we would obviously be fine with that. But we were arguing under 1001B4 based on some of the language in Duncan.
Could we find that this evidence, you know, if it had been objected to, couldn't have come in at all, and nonetheless find that because the appellant agreed to it coming in, that it was not therefore not plain error?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal? Thank you. That concludes the argument. The case is now submitted, and we appreciate the presentation of counsel today. That concludes our oral arguments regularly scheduled for the calendar year. And with best wishes for the holiday season, the court will be in recess.